Certainly glad that you're here this evening, and I trust you've got your Bibles open to Ecclesiastes chapter 5, as we want to continue tonight our look at the book of Ecclesiastes and the lessons that we can learn from the wise man Solomon concerning life here on earth. We reminded ourselves every week that the book of Ecclesiastes is written by Solomon after he, seemingly at the end of his life, as he looks back over some of the mistakes that he had made and some of the lessons that he had learned. And the point of the book of Ecclesiastes really is to tell us that without God, life is meaningless. We can seek happiness or try to find happiness in material things or in doing everything we want to do in pleasure and pursuit of pleasure or in the pursuit of earthly knowledge, but all of those things are ultimately going to leave us lacking meaning in life. They're not going to last. Without the Lord, life is meaningless. And that man was put here for the purpose of fearing God and keeping his commandments. And this is what makes man whole and what makes man complete. Solomon is particularly focused in upon life under the sun. It's one of the key terms that occurs some 30 times, about 39, I believe, in the book of Ecclesiastes. And what that tells us is Solomon is talking about life here on earth. And while he does mention the judgment day, and while he does talk about preparing for that time, he's making the point in the book of Ecclesiastes that serving God is what makes for the best life here. It's not just about eternity. That's the most important thing. And certainly we need to prepare for that time in which we're going to stand before God in the judgment day. But as we seek to live lives that are full and happy here upon this earth, we need to serve the Lord. And so God makes for the best life here. And everything else is fleeting. It may bring us happiness, but it's happiness that is going to be short-lived. It's not going to last. Solomon, throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, is not telling us that money doesn't make us happy. What he's saying is the happiness that money brings is not going to last very long. He's not telling us that sometimes people aren't happy when they're pursuing their pleasures and their sin. But it's not a long-lasting happiness and pleasure. It is very short-lived, and very soon it's fleeting, and then they're finding something else or looking for something else to try to give them fulfillment here upon this earth. And so the book of Ecclesiastes is divided into four different discourses. Discourse 1, which we've already completed, talks about there's nothing in life that can be depended on to bring fulfillment. The ability to enjoy life is a gift that God gives to those that are serving Him. And it's not within man to extract happiness in himself from the things that this world has to offer. Discourse number 2 tells us God has a plan that has a purpose, and man has to fit into that plan. There's a time for all the differing things mentioned in chapter 3 in the Lord's providence and His plan. I know there's a plan. I know God is in control and is in charge, but I can never fully understand everything about it. And therefore, I just simply have to trust the Lord. And we'll talk more about that in chapter 5 tonight. Then discourse number 3, Solomon deals with some of the objections to God that are raised to God being in control. And then he ties up the loose ends and tells us to fear God and keep His commandments. Chapter 5, we're ready to begin tonight, is part of the second discourse. And in the second discourse, we gave basically a 4-point outline of that second sermon, if you will. That begins by laying down a principle. The principle is God has a plan into which every man must fit. God's the one that's in control. The second is the problem. There's the examination of apparent contradictions to God being in control. If God's in control, then why is there wickedness in the place of rulers? Why is this taking place if God is in control? And we talked about some of that last week. The implications, some cautions about some moral and ethical imbalances in life. That is, we need to be cautioned that when we're dealing with things we don't understand, that we don't say or do things that we do not mean. And therefore, I think Solomon cautions us in chapter 5 about some ethical and immoral or moral imbalances. And then he draws his conclusion at the end of chapter 5. So if you have your Bibles open, we're ready to begin in chapter 5. And these warnings that Solomon gives concerning some imbalances that we might find ourselves like the individual described here in chapter 5 if we are not careful. He begins by telling us to walk prudently when we go into the house of the Lord. More appropriately, it would be translated, as it is in the ESV and New American Standard, to guard your steps when you go into the house of the Lord. In other words, watch your step. And when you go into the house of the Lord, be sure you go into the house of the Lord with the right attitude and with the right outlook. As we guard our steps when we go into the house of the Lord, he said, first of all, we need to draw near to hear rather than to give sacrifices. I think Solomon here is warning, particularly in verses 1 through verse 7, about how sometimes we might respond to situations that we can't explain in life. And sometimes I think when we find ourselves in a circumstance where maybe it's suffering, maybe it's in our own lives, maybe it's in the lives of someone we care about, that we can find ourselves reacting in an inappropriate manner. And one of the things we can do is we can come to draw near and we offer the sacrifice of fools as if we're going to pay the Lord off. Or we find ourselves going to complain to God about how things are instead of going to listen to the Lord. Or we may find ourselves making vows to the Lord. Lord, if you just do this or remove this, then here's what I'm going to do. And so I think there's a warning here that is sounded upon these inappropriate reactions sometimes of men. And one is, when you draw near to God, draw near to listen to the Lord rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools. The sacrifice of fools, I believe, are sacrifices that are not offered in accordance with God's will. Because he describes them as sacrifices of fools, and says, for they do not know that they are doing evil. In other words, here are individuals that come to offer sacrifices to the Lord, and yet what they're offering is actually evil. It's not what God wants. Sometimes men will find themselves in situations where there are difficulties that are faced, where there's suffering that is going on in their lives and the lives of others, and they come to offer worship to the Lord, but the worship they're offering is not the worship God wants. It's the sacrifice of fools. And what he's saying is, instead of coming and offering the sacrifice of fools, come near to God with the idea of saying, Lord, what do you want me to do? Let me hear your word and be sure that what we're doing is what God wants us to do. I mean, do you not see in life sometimes on a national level, sometimes maybe on an individual level, where something bad happens and all of a sudden church buildings are full and people are talking about the Lord, but what they're doing is they're offering sacrifices of fools. They're not coming with the Lord with the attitude that says, Lord, let me learn your will and do what you want me to do. Instead, they turn to the Lord and they offer the sacrifice of fools. And what Solomon is saying is, when you go to the house of the Lord, be sure you're doing what God wants you to do, not just coming to offer a sacrifice to the Lord that the Lord's not going to accept. Now, the other reaction that sometimes that people have is they're rash with their mouth. Listen to verse 2. Do not be rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth, therefore let your words be few. For a dream comes from much business, and a fool's voice with many words. Don't be rash with your mouth. You know, sometimes when we don't understand, we can even find ourselves lashing out at the Lord in those circumstances. Why, God, did you do this? And just as an example of that, I think Job did that. Job in the book of Job, we talk about his perseverance, his steadfast, but you know, there are times in the book of Job, Job says to the Lord, why are you using me for target practice? Lord, do you realize what you're doing to me? And he complains to God, and he's rash. It's later on in the book that Job says, over in the book of Job, if you've got your Bibles, if you'll turn there, look at the book of Job, and toward the very end of that book, chapter 38, I believe it is, or chapter 40. Listen, the Lord said to Job, shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? And he argues with God, let him answer. You've argued to me, you've said things about me. And Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once and I will not answer twice, and I will proceed no further. What Job said is, yes, I said some things I should not have said. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put my hand on my mouth and I'm going to be quiet now. But here's the point. Sometimes when we're in a situation like Job, we might find ourselves being rash with our mouth. And this is what Solomon said. Remember, God's in control. He's in heaven and you're on earth. You don't see everything God sees. You don't know everything that God knows. Be careful in circumstances like that, that you're not rash in your mouth. Many words will lead us to say things we should not say. Many words sometimes leads us to say things we shouldn't say. Don't be rash with your mouth. Don't make vows to God you can't keep. Listen to verse 4. When you pay a vow to God, do not delay paying it. For he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. You ever known somebody in a difficult circumstance? And then all of a sudden they say, well now, if the Lord would just, and they make a statement, if the Lord would just do this for me or remove this, then here's what I'm going to do. I've had people say before, you know, if the Lord would just do this for me, then I tell you what, I'll be there and do anything for him. I'll be there at every service. And then pretty soon that vow that they made, they forget about it. And they don't keep it. I think about rash vows. I think about in the book of Judges. You remember how the judge vowed the first thing that walks through the door when I, you know, Jephthah, first thing that walks through the door when I get back, I'm going to give that to the Lord. There's a rash vow that in a moment where he thought he needed the Lord's help, when he did need the Lord's help, he made a vow, and then to his credit, they followed through with that. But don't be rash with your mouth in those moments and make a vow that you're not going to keep. In fact, David in the book of Psalms chapter 15 commends the man that makes the vow and keeps it to his own hurt. That is, he makes a vow, and even though there's a price to be paid for it, he's willing to keep that vow and follow through with it. But in times of difficulty, draw near to hear rather than to give sacrifice. Don't be rash with your mouth and say things you don't mean. And don't make vows to God that you can't keep. And don't let your mouth cause you to sin. Let not your mouth lead you to sin. And do not say to the messenger, that was a mistake or an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there is also vanity, but fear God. Don't let your mouth cause you to sin. Don't say to God, you made a mistake. Lord, you messed up. Sometimes, here's a biblical principle I think that's important for you and I to understand as we deal with suffering in our own lives and we deal with suffering in the lives of others. That is, number one, when somebody's in the midst of suffering, sometimes they say things they don't really mean. And I think that's the case with Job. And sometimes when we're dealing with individuals in difficult circumstances, we have to be mindful of that. That sometimes you say things you don't mean. But I tell you, the lesson in that for me, and I think this is what Solomon is driving at, you better be careful that you don't say something. Because whether or not we would have said it in other times or not, when it's off our lips, then we have been led into sin. We've done wrong when we charge the Lord with making a mistake. And so we need to be careful that we don't say to God, you made a mistake. Do not cause God to be angry with you. So walk prudently when you go to the house of the Lord. And be sure that you come near and don't let your mouth cause you to sin, but instead fear and trust the Lord. That's how we need to respond in moments that we don't understand why it's the time for maybe some of the difficult things as opposed to the times for rejoicing. Then he talks about comfort in oppression in verses 8 and verse 9. Sometimes you look at the world around us, and this was some of the objections that might have been made back in the previous chapters, to say, well, you know, if God's in control, then why is there wickedness in high places? And maybe sometimes you wonder that. You look at the world we live in, and you look at our nation, and you think, now, why in the world is he in charge? Or why in the world is he in a place, or she in a place of leadership? And this is what Solomon says here, look in verse 8. If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel or be amazed at this matter, for a high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all, even the king is served from the field. And he who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, but he who loves abundance with increase, this also is vanity. You know what he's saying? He said, here's your comfort in oppression. Someone is over all the high officials. And I think he's driving at the point that sometimes we look and we say, now why is he there? Well, just always remember this. There's somebody over those high officials. I think ultimately he's talking about the Lord being the highest of all. Remember Nebuchadnezzar, the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men? Paul would make a point when he talked about the masters and telling the masters to treat their servants in the right way. Remember, you've got a master that's in heaven. There is nobody on earth that there's not somebody over them. And ultimately, God is over all men. And therefore, the king is an advantage. There's an advantage in having a king. But there is gain, he said in verse 9, for a land in every way. A king committed to cultivated fields. And I think one thing he's pointing out is the American Standard says the king is an advantage to a land with cultivated fields. And that is sometimes we find ourselves complaining about maybe how things are and how the king, in this case in the days of Ecclesia, is running things. In our day and time it may be, you know, the president or the Congress. But keep this in mind. That there's one thing that is worse than no government at all, and that is anarchy. You know, as bad as sometimes things are, I think Solomon is saying, remember, there's an advantage to the fact that we have laws in place and we have governing officials. And think about how bad things would be without any laws. Things wouldn't be any better. Things would be much worse if we didn't have men that served in the government and led us. And so there's comfort in the time of oppression to remember that, yes, somebody's going to, ultimately these men are going to have to answer to somebody over them. Always keep that in mind. But also keep in mind that as bad as it is sometimes in terms of those that we have leading us, it could be worse. We could have nobody that's in those places of leadership. And then he talks about the vanity of riches in verses 10 through verse 17. And what he tells us about riches is this. And this is going to be brought out even more fully when we come into chapter 6. But again, he's pointing out that we say sometimes, well now, if God's in control, why are these people prospering over here? Why do they have riches if God's in control? Well, riches are vain. Remember, riches don't satisfy, verse 10. No one who has riches ever has enough to say, I don't want any more silver. He who loves abundance will increase. Here's the vanity of riches. We tend to think about material things satisfying us. But have you ever known somebody that was rich that finally just said, you know what? I don't have enough money. I don't want any more. You know? I mean, have you ever watched a ball player sign a $1 million contract and then say, you know what? When they offer him more money, you know what? I don't want any more. I've got all I need. Have you ever seen a CEO of a company that has millions of dollars finally just begin giving his goods away because he said, you know what, I've made all I want to make. I've got all the money I need. And really what he's pointing out, Solomon, and an observation tells us, is riches never satisfy. The more we have, the more we want. And so we sometimes think, well, wealth would be good, but remember, it's not going to satisfy. It's not going to make us whole. It's not going to make us complete. Just look at people that have a lot of money, and you can see that. Also realize wealth brings problems. When goods increase, his expenses increase. Listen to what he says in verse 11 and 12. When goods increase, they increase that eat it. And what advantage has the owner but to see them with his eyes? One problem that wealth brings is when goods increase, your expenses increase. In other words, the more I make, in this particular case, the more people I have that are wanting something out of me, the more I'm having to feed. And so we sometimes think, well, man, what if I had more money? Well, if I had more money, I tell you what that'd mean. It means I'd have to pay more taxes. And if I had more money, you know what that'd mean? That means I'd probably have more expenses that went along with that in order to keep up what I'm doing in order to have the wealth isn't the answer to all the problems. It has problems of its own. Not only that, the common laborer works hard and rests well. Rich men cannot sleep because he worries about his wealth. Listen to what he says in verse 12. Here's some of the problems that riches can bring. He said, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but to the abundance of the rich man will not permit him to sleep. You know, that common laborer out there, the man that gets out there and he works hard for a living every day, I tell you what, he may not have a lot on the table, but when it comes bedtime, he's ready to sleep because he's worked hard for what he's got. And his sleep is sweet. But you got a rich man, and he can't sleep at night. Do you know why? Because all of his wealth. Maybe because he didn't work hard for it, but beyond that, he's worried about it. He's worried about what's going to happen. You know, in our day and time, we might say, you know, the one that's rich, he's worried about where's the stock going to go. You know, is it going to be up or is it going to be down? Am I going to lose this money? What about this? And he can't sleep because he's worried about it. You see, wealth brings, probably not an answer to problem, wealth brings some problems of its own. Not only that, wealth can cause harm in verse 13. We think wealth is good, but it can cause harm. Look at verse 13. There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun. Riches kept for the owner to his own hurt or to his own harm. Wealth can cause problems. We can find ourselves looking down, abusing those that have less than us, James 5 and verse 3. How about, we think about an illustration of that principle. What about the rich ruler, Matthew chapter 19? Do you think that's an individual whose wealth was kept to his own hurt and his own harm? Because he was willing to put that before he put the Lord. Riches don't satisfy. They bring problems. They can cause harm. They can be lost quickly. Look at verse 14 to verse 16. But those riches perish through misfortune or mismanagement. There's nothing. He gets a son. There's nothing in his hand. And when he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came. And he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. In other words, wealth can be lost quickly. It can be lost by theft. It can be lost by poor business decisions, by accidents, by uncontrolled events. I don't know, over the last few years, I've heard many people tell me how much they lost, for example, out of a retirement account when maybe a stock went down or a company folded. And we, you know, the individuals back when years ago when the stock market collapsed may have lost it everything just like that. Sometimes it's through fault of their own. Sometimes it's through no fault of their own that things are lost through poor investment and poor business decisions and accidents that have taken place that take our money. But wealth can be lost very quickly. And it might be that we've got wealth and all of a sudden it's gone. We don't even have anything to leave our children when we're gone. In fact, I think one thing Solomon says is there's one thing that all of us do when we leave this world, that is every man is bankrupt at death. Verse 15, when he goes to his mother, you know how he goes? He goes naked with not a thing in his hand. It doesn't matter whether we have wealth here or not. When we leave this world, every one of us leaves bankrupt without a thing at all to our name. And that's what Solomon is saying. We think, oh, what about wealth? Look at these people over here. Look what they've got. Oh, you know, how do we explain that if God is in control? Well, wealth isn't all it's cracked up to be sometimes. Wealth can bring problems. It doesn't satisfy. It can be lost quickly. And the days of the rich can be full of sorrow and sickness and anger. We find ourselves envying the rich sometimes. But listen, he said, all his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. Just because somebody has a lot materially doesn't mean they're happy. It doesn't mean they've been blessed by God. That rich man can have days that are full of sorrow and sickness and anger. So what does that mean? What that means is I've got to learn that the ability to enjoy the pleasures of life is a gift that comes from God. It's not found in what I possess, but it's found in service to the Lord. Listen again to what he says, verse 18. Behold, what I've seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life, because God keeps his days occupied with the joys of his heart. In other words, get the ability to enjoy life has to come from God. But then Ecclesiastes chapter 6, which is actually the beginning of the third discourse, in chapter 6 and 7, Solomon really points out that things are not always what they seem to be. And I always remember this section using the phrase, Walter Kaiser used it in his book on Ecclesiastes, you can't judge a book by its cover. In other words, sometimes we ask, well, now, if God's in control, then why are things this way with this person and this person over here is doing well? And what Solomon points out in Ecclesiastes 6 and 7 is things aren't always what they seem to be. Ecclesiastes chapter 6, he says prosperity is not always nor necessarily a good thing. And so we look at somebody over here and we say, well, now, God's really blessed them. Look at all they've got. Well, maybe not. Things aren't always what they seem in our limited human viewpoint. And in chapter 7, he said adversity is not always nor necessarily bad. We look over here and we say, oh, look at what's happened to these people. That's terrible. Well, maybe not. Maybe there is a reason behind that adversity. Remember this, things aren't always what they seem. You can't judge a book by its cover. Well, here's what he said in Ecclesiastes chapter 6. One might be prosperous, but not enjoy life. It is an evil that he says he observed under the sun. And the evil that he has observed is God has given to somebody riches, wealth, and honor so that he lacks nothing for himself of all that he desires. He's got everything he wants, but God does not give him the power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity and evil affliction. In other words, God gives him all the wealth. He doesn't lack anything he wants, but what God doesn't give to him is the ability to enjoy what he's worked for. And he describes a situation where an alien or a foreigner might come in and take everything he enjoys. He may not be satisfied with goodness. Look at verses 3 to verse 6. A man begets 100 children. Now that's a sign of divine favor. Now that's not literal there. When he talks about somebody having 100 children, much like it later on, he's going to talk about 1,000, if he lives 1,000 years in verse 6. All of this is used to describe what many would have thought was divine. He's been abundantly blessed. He's got 100 children. And his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed he has no burial. I say that a stillborn child is better than he. For it comes in vanity, departs in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. Though he has not seen the sun or known anything, this has more rest than that man. He said, here's a man that he has 100 children. It seems from our eyes, from our standpoint, when we look, we think, oh, look how blessed he is. But God does not give him the ability. He doesn't enjoy the goodness. And what Solomon said is, I tell you what, it'd be better for a stillborn child is better than the situation he finds himself in. You can't judge things by how we view them. Because our viewpoint is so limited that we look and we say, look at all he's got. Look at the house he lives in. Look at the prosperity he has. But maybe he is as miserable as he can be because he has not been given the ability to enjoy that. Prosperity is not always nor necessarily good. And you know what happens to him? He goes to the same place everybody else goes. He goes to the same place everybody else goes. Look at what he said. Moreover, verse 6, rather, even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to the same place. We look at that person and we envy the person that's got all this money. And what Solomon said is he's not enjoying it many times. And secondly, he could live 1,000 years twice over. But you know what what's going to happen to him? He's going to die. He's going to go to the same place you go. He's going to go to the grave, just like everybody else. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 20. And the riches don't satisfy. We've made that point already in chapter 5. But man works and is not satisfied. Look at verse 7. All the toil a man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. He works, but he's not satisfied. Neither the wise, the fool, the rich, or the poor can satisfy themselves. He said in verse 8, in that sense, the poor man is in the same boat as the rich man. And better in the sight of, it's better to be satisfied with what we have than to strive for things we don't have. Verse 9. You know, it's interesting that some of the most content people I've known in life are some of the people that had the least. Some of the people that I've known that are the most content are people that had the least amount of material things, but they were satisfied with what they had. And what Solomon is saying is better be satisfied with what we have. It may not be much than it is to strive for things we don't have. And that's sometimes what those that have more materially find themselves doing. Remember, God's in control. Remember, God is in control. This is what he said here in verses 10 to verse 12. You can't contend with one who is mightier than you. You can't contend with one that is mightier than you. And therefore, man really does not know what is best for him. Man doesn't always know what is best. Listen to what he said in verse 10. Whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger or mightier than he. The more words, the more vanity. And what advantage is that to man? For he, who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? I think here's the point he's making. Well, things aren't always what they seem.
Things don't all, you can't judge a book by its cover. Remember this, God's the one that's in control, and I can't contend with the Lord anyway, and God knows better than I do what's best for me. God knows better than I do what's best for me. But I tell you, the second part of that is in chapter 7, very quickly, and that is, just like prosperity and riches, what we consider to be good things aren't always good. Sometimes we look and we see individuals that are suffering, adversity, if you will, and adversity is not always a bad thing. And sometimes God allows us to face adversity for our good. Look at the value of suffering. Suffering is compared to mirth in verses 1 to verse 4. And there's a number of things that he says here, that this is better than that. A good name is better than precious ointment. And I think he's saying, you know, what if what I had is a good name, a good reputation, particularly a good name from the Lord, versus somebody that's got valuable precious ointment? Well, what's better? Well, I tell you what, I'd rather have a good name, is what Solomon is saying, than I had to have all the precious ointment in the world. But not just that. He goes on to say that the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. Things aren't always what they seem. You know, we get all excited when a baby's born. And most of us can probably remember the joy of our own children's birth. And yet, we may have been present when someone dies and departs from this world, and it's a sad occasion. But I tell you, the one to be envied is not the one that just entered the world of sin and sorrow and wickedness, but it's the one that's faithfully served the Lord that's getting to leave. And he's better off. I tell you, his day of death is better than the day of his birth. And not only that, Solomon said, I tell you what, a funeral's better than a party. Verses 2 and verse 4, it's better to go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting, for this is the end of all men, they live and will take it to heart. I don't know about you, but I'd rather go to a party any day than I had to go to a funeral. I mean, there's something to be said about, and he's not saying that those things are wrong. He's not saying that a party is wrong or the house of feasting is wrong. But I tell you, I learned something valuable at a funeral home that I can't learn when I go to a house of feasting. And that is, I learn and reminded of my own mortality. That I'm going to be there someday, and I'm reminded of the need to make preparations for that. The day of death is better than the day of one's birth. A funeral is better than a party. And sorrow is better than laughter. Listen to verse 3. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. Sorrow serves a purpose. And in fact, the sorrow makes the rejoicing better, I think is one thing that Solomon points out here in this passage. And so suffering is contrasted with mirth and saying, you know what? Sometimes the things that we think are so bad are things we really need. And so you can't always judge a book by its cover. Not only that, the rebuke of the wise is better than the song of fools. Had you rather have somebody pat you on the back and say you're great and you're wonderful and sing your praises, or have somebody come and rebuke you for some wrong that's been done? I think most people would probably say that they'd rather hear praise than they had rebuke. But I tell you what we need sometimes is the rebuke of the wise. Because that's what helps make us what we are. Listen to what he said. In fact, he compared it, the song of fools, to the crackling of thorns under a pot. You ever built a fire that had thorns in it and you hear a lot of crackling and noise, but you know what it doesn't do? It doesn't really provide any valuable source of heat, does it? And that's sort of what the song of fools is like. The flattery and the song that you hear, it may sound good, but I tell you what, it really ain't any valuable. It's really not valuable for us. Sometimes the rebuke is what we need. And it's a more lasting value. Then he says, the end is better than the beginning. It's better to be patient than proud. In other words, the end of a thing is better than the beginning. Look at what he said here in verses 8 and verse 10. The end of a thing is better than its beginning. The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. And do not say, why were the former days better than these? For you do not inquire wisely concerning this. In other words, when things come to an end, it's better to be patient and endure through those things and look to the end than it is to proudly resist in the present. And I think one thing that Solomon is trying to point out is don't be quick to anger, for it is foolish. And secondly, don't be quick to talk about the good old days. You know, when things are difficult, when suffering is present, We are very bad. And I'm not just talking about me and you specifically. I'm talking about men in general. Are very bad to talk about how good things were. The good old days. And I tell you, there's a couple of problems with that. Number one, the good old days aren't always near as good as we remember them to be. You know, time has a way of sort of editing out all the difficulties and the problem. All we remember is the good things. And it reminds me of the people of Israel when they came out of Egyptian bondage and they asked Moses, said, oh, that you had left us back in Egypt. Oh, don't you remember those big old flesh pots we sat next to and all those onions we ate and the cucumbers? You know, what they failed to mention was the brick making and the abuse. And oftentimes when we talk about the good old days, they're not near as good as what we remember. But I tell you what I really believe Solomon is saying is the good days aren't behind, the good days are ahead. You know, when I'm thinking about the good days are not the old days. The good days are the days we've got to look forward to when we're with the Lord and when He's rewarded. So don't be quick to look back. Instead, be patient in spirit and endure and get through these difficulties that maybe the Lord has appointed for our benefit. Wisdom is a defense and can help us in those times, in verse 11 and in verse 12. We need wisdom to help through. And we need to submit to God's providence. We can't change it anyway. Listen, what he said in verse 13, consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he's made crooked? In other words, I can't change what the Lord wants to do, even if I wanted to. I need to trust that He knows what's right. But if the Lord has made it crooked, I can't straighten it out. But this is what I need to do. I need to submit to the providence of God. This is what He said. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. I tell you what, when it's my day of prosperity and my time for the laughter and my time to be joyful, then I need to appreciate those times and I need to be joyful. And I tell you, when the day of adversity comes around and there are days of adversity for all of us, I need to take moments to consider what lessons I learn from those times of adversity. And I think one thing that Solomon is pointing out in Ecclesiastes chapter 7 is we always think prosperity and rejoicing is good and adversity is bad, and sometimes adversity is good for us. And God has given it to us for a reason, because it teaches us some very valuable lessons. And when those times of adversity come, you know, I need to consider. I need to learn the lessons. For so that man, as he says here, surely God has appointed one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. God has appointed the good as well as the bad. Remember this, God disciplines those He loves. Discipline is never present. Sometimes those times of adversity are given in my life and in your life, not because God doesn't care, but because He does care. And that's what I have to, I don't always understand it all. Solomon says that. But sometimes we need to understand that things aren't always what they seem. You can't judge a book by its cover. I know our time's getting away from us, but I'm going to finish up chapter 7 here. An accurate assessment of man's character explains some apparent inequalities in God's providence. And I think this is what Solomon is saying. We're bad to sit back and say, now, why did that happen to them? They are good people. Or why did it happen to me? After all, I'm good. So why is the adversity and the difficulties being faced by me? And this is what Solomon says. Don't be overly righteous nor overly wise. Verses 15 to verse 18. I've seen a vanity. There's a just man who perishes in his righteousness. And there's a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. But do not be overly righteous nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish, for should you die before your time. What's he saying? Well, what he's saying here is Solomon is not saying, as Brother Waldron said, that one can be too righteous in the sense of pleasing God and actually doing His will. But he's referring to the efforts some make to go beyond what is required. They invent their own rules for obtaining holiness and righteousness. They become guilty of will worship and appoint all sorts of ordinances which may make quite an impression on their observers, but which have little value in guarding against the indulgence of the flesh. And so I think when he's talking about don't be overly righteous, he's talking about those that sometimes go beyond what God has done, and sometimes they make rules that God hasn't made. And here's the point. You know, if we were to go out in the world and we were to ask people to describe their friends and their neighbors and individuals they go to church with, most of them would say they're good, righteous people. But many of those individuals are not submitting to the righteousness of God. They're following their own way. They're doing their own thing. And so I think one thing Solomon is saying is, when I understand, first of all, that some that claim to be righteous aren't really righteous. Too much, Kaiser says in his commentary, passes for true piety, which is not piety at all. In other words, some of what men consider to be piety isn't really true righteousness at all. It's man-made standards and man-made worship. Not only that, he goes on to say, wisdom strengthens the wise and nobody's perfectly sinless. Well, sometimes bad things happen and I can't explain it, but we get to think, well, I'm just too good for that to have happened to me. Listen to what verse 22 says. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed others. All this I have tested by wisdom, and I said I will be wise, but it is far from me. You know what Solomon is saying in verse 20 through verse 22? There's nobody that's sinlessly perfect. In other words, sometimes we think, well, now, why is this happening to me? I'm too good for that. Well, what Solomon says is, which one of you has never sinned? Which one of you has never done anything wrong? We look at others and we say, oh, now, did you hear what she said? But if I took a good, honest look at myself, I may find out I've done exactly the same thing they've done. And so he said, I look at my servant and he's cursed, but you know what? I condemn him, but I've done the same thing. And I think what he's saying there is sometimes when we understand, we say, why do bad things happen to good people? Well, who's really good in the sense that they're perfectly good and have committed no sin at all? And the answer is there's none that fit that category. And finally, the difficulty of obtaining true wisdom. Solomon said, I've worked to fully obtain it. And yet, I haven't got it yet. I work to be wise, and nobody can fully attain the wisdom to understand everything. And I turn my heart to know and search out and seek wisdom and the scheme of things, to know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. This is what I learned. I find something more bitter than death. What's worse than death? Well, falling into the hands of the wicked woman. He said, the woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are fetters, he who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner's taken by her. Tell you what I have found is that falling into the hands of the wicked woman is worse than death. So if anybody knew that, Solomon knew that. And he knew the danger of the wicked woman and falling into her hands. Behold, this is what I found, says the preacher, while adding one thing to another to find the scheme of things, which my soul has sought repeatedly, but I have found none. One man among a thousand I have found. In other words, when I looked among men, I could find one wise man in a thousand. It's rare to find one who possesses true wisdom. And then Solomon said, when I looked among women, I couldn't find anybody that was wise. Now, some have taken Solomon here and have accused him of being a chauvinist and all. When he says here that I couldn't find one among a thousand among women that were wise. But here I think's the answer to that. Some say, by the way, and it may be the case, that when he talks about a thousand, Solomon had 300 wives and 700 concubines. If you add that together, you get a thousand. And that's what he has in mind there. And that may be the case. But I think what you have to understand the context is he's talking about the wicked woman whose heart is a snare and a fetter to him. Look back at verse 26. When he talks about, I find something more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and hearts, and whose hands are fetters. And true wisdom is not found in that kind of woman. Now remember this, Solomon is the same man that when he described wisdom in the book of Proverbs, described her as a woman. This is the same man that would, in other passages, talk about wisdom being available to all. And so, you know, the Bible talks about wise women. So I think it's unfair to assign Solomon here being a chauvinist who thought that women could not possess wisdom. But it has to be understood in this context about the kind of woman that he is talking about. But then he said, God made us upright, but we've gone after many schemes. In other words, why has man gone after the way he is? Well, just keep this in mind. We've gone astray, but it's not because God made me that way. God made us upright, but we've gone after many schemes. And so, how do we explain things when it seems sometimes like things aren't fair? Well, here's what Solomon says, I think, in chapter 6 and chapter 7, is in essence this. You don't judge a book by its cover. And sometimes things aren't what they seem. Because sometimes somebody's prosperous and we look and they have the nice house and they drive the nice cars and they have a lot of money, but they are miserable because God hasn't given them the ability to enjoy that. And when they leave this world, they may lose it and leave everything behind. They are going to leave everything behind. And on the other hand, we may look at somebody that's going through some difficulties. Maybe they're having to go to the house of mourning. Maybe they've heard the rebuke of fools. Maybe it's time of sorrow. But it could be that God has given that sorrow or that mourning to them because it's beneficial to them. Not because He doesn't care, but because He does care. And He recognizes that that's what's best for them at that point in time. And when we begin to think, well, why do things like that happen to us? Remember this, we've all sinned and transgressed God's law. Every one of us has sinned. God made us upright. We've gone astray. And sometimes we have to deal with those times of difficulties because of our own decisions that we've made and sins that we've committed. And when I begin to understand what Solomon is saying here in these chapters, then I can begin to grasp and cope with situations that I don't always understand because I realize that I don't have the full view of things that God has. And God is a God that's all wise and all knowing. And I just simply have to trust Him that He knows and has a better view than what I have. And if I serve Him faithfully, ultimately, I'll be rewarded. And that's the good days that we're looking forward to. Get your song book out. We're going to stand in just a moment. We're going to sing the invitation song that was announced. When we do, that'll be the proper time for one that needs to respond to obedience to the gospel. If you're not a Christian, would you not become one this evening by rendering obedience to the gospel and being buried in the waters of baptism? Or maybe there's somebody that's obeyed but has wandered away from the Lord. This may be the last opportunity you have, so why not come back to Him and make the correction in your life that you need to make? We're going to do that right now together. We stand and we sing.